In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine, where this week we're chatting to Rebecca Thorne. Rebecca's new book, The Grief House, is out right now, and it comes after a switch of genre and a switch of name too. We talk about how her working day is tightly planned, also how a pseudonym changes her headspace and helps her switch off. And you can hear why she's trying to write without thinking of any genre at all.
The beginning of my writing career, I was definitely writing what I thought the market wanted to read. So I was trying really hard to be a psychological thriller writer, because I love reading those books, and they're great to read. So I really wanted to write one, and I did. I wrote two, and I'm really proud of them. They're great. They're good books, but it wasn't where I was comfortable writing. And the other thing I realized is that the deadline, that idea of writing a book a year, that doesn't come from the writer, that comes from a marketing department. That comes from a sales team who want to have a new book for the writer every single year. So that idea that every writer should be able to sit down, knock out a draft in 6 months and spend 6 months editing, that doesn't come from the writer. So as soon as you kind of sit back and you appreciate that, and I thought, well, I don't want to kind of do this thing that I find really difficult to do and it's driving me mad. I just can't write that quickly. And I want to write what I want to write. So having that kind of stern word with myself, and having friends also recognize that and support me, that just advice, just keep going, was kind of what I needed to get over that hump.
More with Rebecca Thorne in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. My name is Dan Simpson, and this is Writer's Routine, where we take a look through an author's working day. We see what they do, how they do it, how they plan their life and day to give them the best chance of getting words down on the page. And this week's episode of Writer's Routine is brought to you by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? And it does something that many true crime podcasts attempt, but very few manage. It puts you right at the heart of the investigation. And it's perfect for you, because if you love your crime writing and storytelling, which I think you probably do, and if you love your podcasts, which I hope you do, well, it's right up your street. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is all about a 1983 murder. It's now regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved murders. And across 5 episodes, told through a mixture of documentary and drama, this series goes into the very centre of a live investigation. As in, it's going on right now, and you can be part of it, with interviews from the senior investigating officer, forensic scientists, psychologists, as well as family members and friends of the victim. And you are there, learning all this at pretty much the same time as the police. It's a classic whodunit case that has baffled everyone for over 40 years. And with the killer still on the run in 2023, just a few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in this case. It's such a brilliant twist on true crime podcasts. It puts you front and center, so you can try and uncover who is the cheese wire killer. Find the series now. You can listen to the whole lot wherever you get your shows. Search for Who is the Cheese Wire Killer and try and solve one of the most famous murders ever. This week we are chatting to Rebecca Thorne. She published two books under the name Rebecca Tinnerly and is now back as Rebecca Thorne with a new novel. It's called The Grief House. Here's a quick look at the blurb. A week-long grief retreat on a beautiful country estate with no phones and no Wi-Fi is an ex-tarot reader blues usual getaway. But ever since her mother's death, she has been carrying a secret. Could this finally help her let it go? Only a few guests make it to the estate through the weather. The storm worsens until they're stranded in the house, cut off from the outside world, and one of the guests disappears in the night, and Blue wonders who around her is telling the truth about why they're there and whose grief might be hiding a deeper secret. We chat about why Rebecca likes to be as cozy as possible for the first draft. Also, how mentoring and teaching writers for the Faber Academy changes the way she thinks about her own stuff. You might remember we spoke to Professor Emma Smith, who teaches Shakespeare studies in Oxford, how being around a subject every day changes how you view it and it grows within you. I wonder how true that is of actually writing when you are a writing too. You can hear about switching genre and the moment that she knew that she wanted to try something new. And we get into why she is very passionate about verb placement. Just a whole new world opened up to me then. Stick around for it. And we dive into it as we always do with what Rebecca Thorne sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
It very much depends on where I am in the writing process. At the moment, I'm in my living room. This is where I would write first drafts. When I'm writing any first draft, I like to make sure I'm incredibly comfortable and as reclined far back as I can. So I kind of stretch out with my legs in front of me, loads of pillows behind me, cushions underneath my knees. And then I can kind of really lie back, relax into it and let my imagination go away with me. So I find that's the best way to write any first draft. Around me, I have all sorts of stuff. I'm quite lucky that I don't find distraction that much of an issue. So around me in my living room at the moment, I've got loads and loads of books. All my bookshelves are in my living room. I've got my kids' toys. I've got yoga equipment and the TV and various, you know, things that need to be tidied away, laundry that needs to be folded, all that sort of stuff. I'm quite lucky that I can, I get almost like a tunnel vision when I write, so I can become incredibly focused very quickly and distractions around me don't tend to bother me. When I start to edit my work, especially if I'm doing something like line edits, then I go into my, I call it my office. It's actually our conservatory, but I've transformed it into an office. So there I have quite a small black desk. And again, a pretty comfortable office chair. I like to look out into the room because it's a conservatory. It's got lots and lots of windows. So I've got lots of light. I can see into the garden. I can see into, I've got the Mendip Hills rising in the distance on one side, and then kind of houses and stone walls and things coming through to the other. I've got a treadmill in the corner and a sofa and various things to do with my cat. So when I'm in the conservatory, I also have the company of my cat. That's where our cat flap is. So she often comes in to pretend to help. Which normally involves meowing very loudly at me and looking for attention.
Yeah, I've got a cat as well, and she's very good at pretending to help while just getting in the way. Well, so many questions. Firstly, not really important or relevant to your writing, but the Mendip Hills, I know the geography of the UK pretty well. I've only been made aware of the Mendip Hills, I would say, in the last year. It's just, yeah, like I know Bristol and I know Somerset, but the idea that there's this mysterious place called the Mendip Hills, it sounds very King Arthurian, really. I mean, tell me it's as idyllic and dreamy as it always sounds.
Oh yeah, it is, absolutely. And it is a really remarkable place because the Mendip Hills kind of hem in the Somerset Levels. So if you're standing on top of the Mendips, in front of you is just this incredible expanse of flat countryside. And if you're standing in the middle of the levels, you've got this like this saucepan-like edge of hills around you. And they're really beautiful, really green. They look very gentle, but they're actually pretty steep once you start climbing them. But they're definitely hills, not mountains. So they're quite low, and they just roll through the distance. And yet it is very kind of Arthurian.
And rather grandly and philosophically, I live in southwest London, so I always feel very busy. Does living in quite a tranquil, peaceful feeling place give you that same state of mind? Do you feel quite leveled and quite chilled and maybe rolling at times?
I don't know if I ever feel entirely chilled and level. I'd be amazed if any writers feel completely level-headed all the time. The peace helps, having the quiet really, really helps. I mean, as I said, at the moment I'm sitting in my living room, there are no cars, there's no sounds of anything apart from the occasional bird song. And I can kind of step outside. I walk a lot. I think most writers tend to walk a lot. It's a great way to get your imagination going and to, you know, wheedle out plot knots and things. So I walk a lot, and I just need to kind of go out of my front door, walk down a few streets, and then suddenly I'm in the countryside, and it really helps. It gives a clarity of mind, which I think is very useful.
You mentioned writing the first draft being as cozy and luxurious as possible. That seems like something that you have learned along the way. In your writing career, when did it dawn on you that the best chance you would have for your first draft is to be as calm and lazy as possible?
I think the word lazy is probably the best one. It probably came back from my student years. So it wasn't a conscious thing I did when writing books. It came from being an incredibly lazy student who liked to go out very late at night and do lots of partying, and then would suddenly realize that they had essays to do and hand in on time. So I used to write all my essays at university in bed. I used to kind of wake up in my grotty student digs with books all, I did English literature at university, so books all over the floor, and I would just kind of like grab my laptop, write, you know, an essay in bed, and then hope for the best. So it comes from there, really. But that worked for me as well, that idea of being very comfortable and kind of just letting your brain take over, letting the body rest and let the brain take over always worked. So I just carried it on. And then when I started writing my first book, this is going back 10 years ago, I had to do that. I had no desk. I was a young mother. I was writing whilst my son was sleeping. I didn't have a desk or an office or anything like that. I just had the sofa. So I just kind of lay on the sofa and did it then. And we used to have one of those like really big sofas where it was almost impossible to sit upright. You had to kind of lie back. And so I started writing on there, and then it worked, basically. It worked on that one, and I've carried on ever since.
Now, your child is not so long that you can only write when he's sleeping. How frantic that must have been, and how time poor you were back then. Does that give you a greater appreciation for now, maybe the room you have to write in now?
Does it? I mean, it's changed a lot. I mean, I'm a single mother to two children now, so it's you take the time where you get it. It helps that they're both at school, so I try to get as much done during the school day as I can. And it gives you an appreciation of time. I don't tend to get distracted. And I also protect that writing time very, very fiercely. So there's no chance on earth that when I come home after dropping the kids off, I'm going to mess about doing laundry or hoovering or anything like that. I'm going to write, and I'm not going to do anything else. It's that at any point in your writing career where time suddenly becomes precious, it teaches you, it's a very valuable lesson, it teaches you to appreciate the time you've got and to make the most of it.
Well, you mentioned lessons there. So when the kids are back, And I'm very conscious, before I ask you this question, I'm very conscious that occasionally when I chat to mums more than dads, I have these chats about looking after the kids a lot more. And, I'm very conscious of that. But very simply, it's because for whatever reason, like, it becomes more of a point of the conversation, like dads, maybe because they're not as there, no criticism, but they tend not to bring it up, right? But
yeah.
So when the kids are home from school, what have you learned about maximizing those little snatches of writing points that you have when they're in, maybe when they're doing the homework, when you don't have to take care of them, when you don't have to do the dinner? Like, how have you learned to maximize those points?
So what I've learned is I am hopeless at writing when they're at home. I need to be able to turn that. I mean, when you're in charge of like any human being, you have that kind of alertness in your brain. I call it like my mother brain is on. And I can't switch that off. And I need to write really well, especially again, first drafts. Editing isn't as bad, but if I'm doing a first draft, I need to have total peace of mind and no one trying to distract me. And I just can't do it. If I'm at home and the kids are at home, I want to make sure they're okay. I want to make sure that they're not about to come in and disturb me. And it's too fraught. So I just don't write any first draft when the kids are at home. I do it all when they're at school. And when they are at home, I've now got to a stage where they're old enough that they've got homework and things and music practice and sports clubs to do. So when they're home with me and they've got those things to do and they don't need my attention, that's when I do admin. That's when I get like admin done, finances done, things like that. Catch up on social media. Anything that I can do to kind of help my career that doesn't involve needing to switch off from the real world.
Well, that might be really helpful, I would say.
Is. Yeah,
Because you've really compartmentalized that time. You've given yourself a hard out, right? It's when the kids get home at 3:30, whenever it is, it's like, right, we're done. I need to get it done there. Just before we have a look at the day and what needs to happen in those 6 hours or so, when you've done your first draft and you go into your grand office, the conservatory, how much does your frame of mind change? How different do you approach that? Are you kind of more serious now you're sat at a desk?
It's a different, I mean, a compartmentalization is probably a good way to put it. It's a different frame of mind. I find that when I'm creating that first draft stage, my sentences are a lot looser. The language isn't as precise. The sentences aren't structured in the way that I would want them to be for the final book. So when I sit down to do edits, then I've got a much more kind of professional head on. I'm looking at what I've written. And first of all, I'd look at what works and what doesn't work on a kind of story level and a character level. And you'd want to, you know, so maybe cut bits out, add bits in, just to make the overall story work and the characters make sense. And then when you go to the more kind of structural side of the sentences themselves, then I want to make sure that the verbs where I want them to be, the wording is exactly, you know, is precise. I want to make sure that the words on the page mean exactly what I want them to mean. So that is a very different frame of mind. It's less, you know, airy fairy, imagine if this happened, and more, right, what do I mean? Let's get it down. I wake up pretty early, about 6:15-ish. My son wakes up. The only reason I wake up so early is because my son wakes up really, really early. So I get up, make sure he's all right. My daughter lies in bed for a bit longer. So the mornings are kind of based around the kids. Get them up, get them ready for school. I'll, you know, shower, dress, walk to school. And then my writing day probably starts the minute that I've dropped them at school gate and I start to walk home. And then I am thinking then about what I'm going to write, where I am in the story, where I finished it the day before, and what I want to achieve that day. So I kind of run that over loosely in my head as I get home. The first thing I actually do is, once I'm back at the house, is yoga. And that's not so much to do with writing. I have a connective tissue disorder called EDS, which means that I need to take very, very good care of my joints and the muscles around my joints. And if I just sat down for 6 hours every day and just wrote, I would fall apart. And we kind of have a joke with my kids where I do yoga to stop my legs falling off. So I come home and I do that. But even whilst I'm doing that, I mean, your writing brain never switches off. So even I'm doing yoga, I'm still kind of thinking about what I want to achieve, what I want to do. And then 9:30, sit down, start writing. And then I will write for about 3 hours, getting up occasionally for tea, coffee, things like that. And yeah, I'm pretty strict with myself. I find it very easy to be strict with myself. I find it a lot easier to sit down and write than I do to, you know, force myself to do pretty much anything else. So that comes very easily. I do that until about 12:30, have a break for a bit of lunch. And then in the afternoon, I have another job. So I work for Faber Academy as a mentor and reader. So in the afternoons then I work to pay the everyday bills. And I do that until about 3:15. And then I walk again, do the school run. That evening, well, even a late afternoon walk is just as important as the morning walk in that it helps me turn my brain off. So if I don't have a space from my creative life to my parenting life, I find it leaks through and I become very distracted. So I try to really mindfully walk in the afternoon to pick the kids up from school, leave everything I've written or read behind me, pay very close attention to where I am right now, so that when I pick the kids up, I can be present with them and they don't feel like their mum is there in body, but not in soul.
So 3 hours of busy morning writing then. Is there an aim, what you'd like to get done? Is it kind of a word count thing? Is it a point of the story? What do you go by?
What do I go by? I mean, in the past, I've done things like give myself word count deadlines. And I find they make me just stressed. So the time one works for me far better. I just make sure that whether I write, 100 words or 2,000 words, during that 3 hours, I'm there and I'm writing. And it might be something that needs to be rewritten 60 times. But as long as I'm there and as long as I've done it and shown up, I'm happy. I'm a really slow writer. It takes me, even working 3 hours a day, it'll take me a good 18 months to get kind of a solid first draft done. Nothing comes. I have a kind of another joke. I just don't do anything quickly in life. My whole body is designed to do things very slowly and very gently. So it takes me a long time. So I try to, as I've got older and I've learned to appreciate that, and I'm just a little bit kind with myself now, I think. I can sit down and think I'm going to get this first draft down in 6 months and it's never going to happen. And the same thing would if I sat down and thought, well, I'm going to write 2,000 words today. And then I ended up writing, 500. I'd end up beating myself up. So instead, I just think I've done 3 hours. I've done 3 hours of serious work and I'm happy.
Is that because your writing is quite purposeful every day? You're trying to get the right words. You're not one of these authors that just gets out anything and then fix it later.
I mean, in a way, I am someone who will get out anything and fix it later, but I'm kind of a mixture of the two. I will kind of write a paragraph and then go back. I'm dyslexic as well, so I find the writing side of it I find quite easy. The correcting side of it I find very difficult, and it takes me a long time to sometimes, if I have an idea of something that I really, really want to write down on the page, it can take me a while to kind of formulate it. Sometimes it comes really quickly and there's no problem with it at all, but sometimes it's like kind of walking through molasses. So it just takes a lot of patience and perseverance and get there in the end. But yeah, I've definitely learned that for me, doing those relatively arbitrary deadlines just do me no favours.
You spoke of how much you've learned about giving yourself time and space and not being too hard on yourself. How much has that always been the case? Knowing how those 18 months tend to go, do you know when you're likely to get very down about the whole thing and just want to tear it up and start again when you want to really beat yourself up because it is taking you quite a long time. How much have you learned about that cycle, and what do you do to push yourself through?
I think I don't do anything to push myself through apart from just keep going. And that advice is something I've just got from friends, other writer friends, and you just keep going, just keep doing it. But the realization that it's going to take me as long as it takes me is, I think it really came about from when I stopped writing under Rebecca Tinley and switched to Rebecca Thorne. It's kind of tied into that story. So the beginning of my writing career, I was definitely writing what I thought the market wanted to read. So I was trying really hard to be a psychological thriller writer because I love reading those books, and they're great to read. So I really wanted to write one, and I did. I wrote two, and I'm really proud of them. They're great. They're good books, but it wasn't where I was comfortable writing. And the other thing I realized is that the deadline, that idea of writing a book a year, that doesn't come from the writer. That comes from a marketing department. That comes from a sales team who want to have a new book for the writer every single year. So that idea that every writer should be able to sit down, knock out a draft in 6 months and spend 6 months editing, that doesn't come from the writer. So as soon as you kind of sit back and you appreciate that, and I thought, well, I don't want to kind of do this thing that I find really difficult to do and it's driving me mad. I just can't write that quickly. And I want to write what I want to write. So having that kind of stern word with myself, and having friends also recognize that and support me, that just advice, just keep going, was kind of what I needed to get over that hump.
It's all well and good as a writer to think that, if I don't want to publish a book a year, then I won't. But surely conversations with your agent and your publisher must have been quite tough to allow you to do that so early on in writing under a new name. How happy are they to hear that this new author that they've signed doesn't want to kind of crack out the books as frequently as they would like?
It's never come up, actually. It's never come up. My agent is a really, really understanding agent. She believes in publishing the best book you can rather than churning out to deadlines. So she's always been really, really supportive. She understands how important it is for me to write what's kind of true to me and what I really want to write rather than writing quickly. So I've never had any pushback. I don't know whether that's just because I'm incredibly, I think it probably is that I'm just incredibly lucky. I've just happened to have found an agent and found a publisher and editor who are very sympathetic to that. But I'm aware that it's not the case for a lot of publishers. And I've heard so many stories from especially debut authors who have spent maybe, 4 or 5 years writing their first book, and they're holding down a full-time job, and they've got a family, and they sign a book deal, and it's a two-book deal. And they're suddenly expected to write the second book, within the space of a year, whilst still having a full-time job and a family life and having to publicize, their first book. It's really hard. And it's not an easy thing. I haven't turned my back on it at all. And I know that there are some writers who can very naturally write that quickly. And there are some that can't. And I think what I'm trying to say is here, I recognize that I can't do it. So I had to look at it from my perspective and recognize that I can't do it. And by trying to force myself to do it, I was making myself miserable.
Yeah, it's all about the... it's all about the money to a degree, isn't it? We heard recently that... I think the average earning for an author could be something like £7,000 a year. And if the money's not there, well, there's no way that you can write a book, two books a year, and expect to publicize them and expect to like earn enough for your family to live on. I think you need to be in a pretty lucky position to get that done. And listen, I even know authors who have had to write three books a year.
Yeah. I just don't know how they did it. I've got a friend who last year he wrote six books. I mean, he's a full-time writer, but he wrote six books, and I just cannot understand how anyone could do that. The sheer speed of it is, I find, incredible. I'm really jealous, actually. That's probably what it is more than anything. I'm really, really jealous.
Just mentioning the pseudonym and the name change there, changing your name and writing under, well, someone that is a name that is not you, does that affect, like, how you view it, like the responsibility that you take over it? I mean, can you do you feel that your voice changes and you can get away with slightly different stuff? I don't know.
I don't think my writing voice changes. What it definitely does is put me in a very it changes my headspace. I find that my writing work leaks less into my private life now. I can I can slot myself into my writer persona. I can do the work when I need to, and then I can take that kind of writer hat off, and then, I can be a present parent or a good friend or, whatever. So it's definitely helped for giving me just a very, very clear professional space in which to work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, almost it's a hat, it's a character that you're adopting for that 6 hours through the day. Just a few more questions on the day. You mentioned your work for Faber Academy. I've interviewed other authors who have both been through and now work for Faber and the Academy program there. How much does reading and helping other people write affect what you do? I asked this, I spoke to a professor of Shakespeare studies the other day, which sounds very grand, but she was...
Wouldn't that be wonderful? I'd love to be a professor of Shakespeare studies.
It's nice, isn't it? Because everyone could have an opinion on it, and it's 400 years old, so you can't really be wrong either. But she was saying how teaching something 400 years old gives her new ideas and new views on it because you're constantly being influenced by other people's opinion. Is it the same when you're reading and helping someone else write?
Yeah, it definitely is. Helping other people work out. More so, I think, the teaching and the reading, they probably go hand in hand. So I do two things with Faber Academy. One is that I will read manuscripts and give feedback on how to make novels better. What's working, what's not working, what can be adjusted to make the book better. And the second is mentoring. So I'll work with writers as they're trying to hone normally their first novel. It does help my own work, but then I sometimes also fall into the trap of overthinking. So if, for instance, I have a student who's struggling to make two characters connect, and I'll research it, I will kind of look at books I know where the character dynamic works really, really well, and try to use examples of those to help the student. I read a lot of style guides and writing manuals. And sometimes that can work really well because then it's fresh in my head when I get back to my own work. And other times I'll then go back to my work thinking, hang on a minute, how is the dynamic between my characters? Is that working well? And so I can sometimes also overthink. So it does help more than it hinders, but sometimes it does also hinder, and I've got to kind of pull myself back and have a breath. But I also just really enjoy it. It's such a privilege working with people on their books and having them kind of trust you and take on board your ideas. And it's... when, especially if I'm at a point in my writing where I'm feeling quite alone with it. So it makes the other thing of taking so long to write a first draft is that no one else has read it. So, I can work for a year before anyone else has even read the book, told me if they think it's working or whether it's not working. So sometimes I can get trapped in my own head worrying about my own stuff. So to be able to come out of that space and help someone else with theirs and see that you are actually having a positive impact on someone else's creative process can be enormously uplifting as well.
And how much, as a writer, are you constantly looking to learn? Are you reading what other people do and looking at, oh, hang on, this is how they're doing it. Maybe that might be an idea for me. How much are you being open-minded with that side of things?
Very. I think that, inspiration is all around us. So, if you keep an open mind, you're inspired. But I think the same thing goes to improving in anything. You need to kind of stay humble in the face of the art. You need to realize that you don't know everything. However good you are, you can always learn more. There's always a different way of doing it. And So by having that kind of open mind and researching and reading and talking to people as much as I can, it definitely has an impact. It really helps me. Staying humble is probably the best way to put it. It starts with getting a massive ego, thinking I'm, an absolute genius, and aren't I enormously clever for having this book published? It makes me realise I've always got stuff to learn. I can always be better.
And just speaking about, again, where you work, you mentioned, it's full of stuff. You've got a lot all around you, but you're fine. You get tunnel vision. There's no distractions. How much do you have around you that lets you know what it is you're there to do? So plot points, perhaps, post-it notes, whiteboards, maybe the odd inspirational quote, Rebecca. You're into your yoga.
Yeah. So as far as inspirational quotes go, I've got a painting that my daughter made for me, which just says, write the damn book. She made that for me about 2 years ago. So I've got that right up there where I can see it. So if ever I do, if ever I am tempted to go and do something else, I've got that staring me square in the face, write the damn book. And then I think my brain works very differently to a lot of other authors I know. And I listened to previous episodes of your podcast. I'm always hearing about writers who have lots of notes and lots of storyboards and everything. And I just keep everything inside my head. I make very, very few notes. I write hardly anything down on pen and paper. I do have storyboards. So I'm writing my next book at the moment, and I'm on kind of the third or fourth draft of it. So after the second draft of a book, I normally do a storyboard, so I know how the chapters work. So I have kind of like a visual guide. But that's normally, to be honest, that's normally the first point I really write anything down. I just kind of keep it all in my head. I've always described my brain as like a spider's web. So I have that in the very center. If you sort of picture a spider web and you've got that kind of circle in the middle, that's why I've kind of keep all of the vital information about character and where I want them to go. And then the rest is just like a web of information. And I don't know what it is. I can just kind of keep it in my brain. So I do that. So I have very little around.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Somebody knows who did it. Someone out there knows who did it.
There's people out there just keeping quiet, not telling us what they know.
My expectation would be
somebody out there knows something.
If somebody would know about it other than just the killer.
I firmly believe
someone out there knows who did it.
Somebody would know about it.
Somebody out there knows something.
Who is the cheese wire killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Who is the cheese wire killer? New true crime podcast is sponsoring the show this week, and you can find the whole lot, search wherever you get your podcasts. And, well, you can support the show as well by getting involved over on Patreon, patreon.com/writersroutine. We have done almost 300 episodes now, coming up very close to that big landmark. And if along the way you have learned anything that has just helped what you do, if it has helped the way that you write your stories and plan your day, well, you can say thanks to us, I guess, for that over at patreon.com/writersroutine. And it doesn't take a lot, just a few dollars a month, whatever it is. It gets you access to everything we've got going on online there. You get merch, there is bonus content, there is even a way for your book to sponsor this show, and it helps me carry on bringing you these episodes with the best authors around as often as possible. If you'd like to support in any way at all, please do take a look at what you can do at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back into it then with Rebecca Thorne chatting about her new novel, The Grief House, and why she wanted it to be genreless, it to be completely independent. She just wanted to tell a story. You can hear about how much she knew about the book before she started writing it. Also why she's very passionate about verb placement and ing words. And we get back into it talking all about The Grief House and how she knew it had to be different to anything that she'd published before.
As with lots of books, lots of authors, I had an idea and it kind of went away. The first idea was just someone arriving in a place to get over something. When I first had the idea, it was actually going to be the character's dad that had died, and they needed to just process it. And I thought, well, how difficult would it be to process if the person you thought was dead kept coming back? So that was the initial kind of kernel of the idea. And then it kind of developed from there. And I made a promise to my dad a long time ago that I would never write any characters based on him. So as soon as the initial idea was, well, this character's dad has died, I had to change it and make it the character's mum. So I didn't get back on that promise to my dad. And I wanted to, as I was kind of moving away from writing psychological thrillers, it was more of an experiment. I didn't want to pigeonhole myself into a genre. So I didn't think, right, I'm going to write a crime novel, I'm going to write a thriller, I'm going to write a supernatural novel or a ghost story. I just wanted to write again. The voice was more important to me than the story itself, I think. Finding character was more important to me than the type of story itself. So first of all, I found the character and it was a character who was in a lot of pain, in blue, had lost her mother, and she wanted to feel whole again.
Just quickly on the genre aspect of it. I mean, that must have been so tricky because you've consciously written psychological thrillers, like you said, this is what sold, this is what I read, so this is what I wanted to write. There's a firm decision in your mind there. It's very hard to approach an agent and a publisher with something that doesn't quite have its genre flag on the mast. How did you push those thoughts to the back of your mind?
I was really naive. I was really naive. I thought, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a book. And the only thing I'm going to concentrate on is writing it really well. So I purposely, I think it was just because I found the whole thing of writing psychological fiction so difficult. And I felt it wasn't really my true voice, and I wanted to get that voice back. So I just really naively thought, I'm going to write a book and I'm just going to make it really good. That's what I'm going to do. And then everything will be fine. And it really was not fine.
But with that, did you find yourself veering into a genre kind of unwittingly, just like you naturally wrote a type of story?
I think it did naturally. It's dark. I think the darkness is what I naturally write very well. So whatever I write is always going to be elements of darkness, creepiness, emotional struggle, emotional pain. They're all going to be there. And they always have been, even in my psychological thriller stuff, they were there. And this was more shaping that into a story that I felt had heart, had characters that were believable and that you could fall in love with, and had just a good story. I think that's what I wanted to do more than anything, was to just write a really good story. So I did. And then, yeah, very naively, I thought it would be, you know, welcomed with open arms. And what I wasn't expecting is that my agent at the time, I've since have a new agent now, but my first agent, who is a wonderful woman, and I really, really respect her, and she is, she's done wonders for other writers. I sent her this book after having written it for about a year and a half, and she absolutely hated it. she, for those exact reasons, it didn't fit into a genre. It wasn't, you couldn't neatly package it into a box. And she especially hated the fact that it mixed these elements of kind of gothic with luxury mystery. So she very politely suggested that I either write a new book or find another agent. So then that's the worst thing that can happen to to a writer, is someone to say, you know, this book you've spent a year and a bit on, I hate it so much, you know, I want you to write something else. And I had to really dig deep then and kind of ask myself what I wanted out of my career, what I wanted to do. And I really believed in the book. So I stuck with the book, parted ways with my agent, fell apart completely. It was just like one of the darkest periods of my life. Lose my agent, because I also had no publisher then either, because I had left Hodder to pursue this idea of writing what I wanted to write. So no agent, no publisher, and a book that I had read and my mum had read and really liked, because mums tend to really like the books their children have written. And I just didn't know what to do. And I'm blessed with some really, really good friends. And they're the friends that the book is dedicated to. They just kind of rally around and, you know, pick me up and said, you know, it's fine. You'll be fine. Keep at it. Keep going. Don't give up. Here's some very practical advice as to what you can do. Chin up, carry on. Believe in your book. So I stuck with the book. And then I re-edited it one more time, because I really wanted to make sure that if I was going to go out on submission again to agents, I have to go through that whole slush pile routine again. It had to be as good as I can get it. So I really paid incredibly close attention to everything, from just word choice to verb placement to sentence length, just everything on a really quite obsessive level. Sent it out, and then luckily people were interested. And I think one of the reasons that agents were interested in it is because it was different. It suddenly didn't fit into those neat, you know, pockets that people were used to. It challenges those traditional genres and it both melds them together and pulls them apart. So it captured people's imagination, I think. So I got an agent, and then pretty quickly got a publisher.
And we will talk more about The Grief House, but just moving on from that and learning that you can kind of do it your own way and get an agent and get the book out there on shelves. How much is it affecting what you're writing going forwards? Because now what happens is, because bookstores need a place to put your book, right? So it might naturally be kind of put into a genre simply for that purpose. How much will you that title and tag of other people telling you what your book is affect how you go and write future novels? How much will you consider that genre going forward?
I am not. I'm trying not to. I'm going back to what I think made The Grief House work, which was writing what's true to me and doing it the best I can. And I think, as I said before, there will always be elements that are the same. There'll always be darkness. There'll always be heart. There'll always be, like, you know, there'll be threads of intrigue. And there'll be good characters. And I think if I do those well, if I do those really, really well, and the voice pretty much stays, I've got quite a strong writing voice. Then it should work. And I don't know. It's a really good question. It's an interesting question. It's one that always makes you feel really uncomfortable, because I feel like stamping my feet and saying, I don't want to write, you know, Grief House take two. I want to write, you know, what I want to write. And the world doesn't work like that.
You might need another name.
I might need another name. I could just do this forever, just bring up new names for every book I write. Hopefully that won't happen. And I think that maybe they should have a new section in bookshops for, you know, pretty dark fiction. I think that would be a great section. I'd go there in a shot. I knew hardly anything about the story before I started writing. I knew about the character, and I knew where they were in their, I knew the place they were in their life. And it was once I started writing, the ideas then started flowing. So once I put kind of Blue in her car and she's driving to this grief house, then it started thinking, well, who would she meet there? Who would be running it? Why is she going? Why was the death of her mother so difficult? And those questions would kind of come up and answer themselves as I wrote. And then I started thinking, I do take moments of pause. So as I said before, I walk a lot. So I will write, but I will also walk a lot. And when I walk, I consider what I've already written, why I might have written that, where I want to take it next, and what would fit well. And normally my partner calls it the hind brain. I have a very active hind brain. A lot of stuff kind of works itself out in my subconscious when I'm sleeping or when I'm walking. So I will kind of muddle these things through. And then once I start writing, it just kind of comes out. I know it's a really unhelpful way to explain it, but it does feel a bit like alchemy at times, this process. I don't even quite understand myself. Kind of just flows onto the page. I remember the clearest point of planning for this book was thinking about Bridget, who Blue's mother, and it's her death that instigates Blue to come to the grief house and work through her various issues. And that came from a article I read probably about 20 years ago. So it was really, I think I even read it, you know, back in the olden days before the internet really kind of took off. It was probably in a newspaper. And the story about the woman in this newspaper was pretty much exactly what happened to Blue's mother. And this has plagued me and troubled me my whole adult life. I've found myself mulling it over and coming back to it. And I thought, when I started writing this, I wonder if I could weave that in. So I tried to find the story again. And I thought it must be easy to find, because surely this can't have happened to any more than, you know, maybe one or two people in the history of the world. And when I tried to find it, I couldn't, because there were so many stories. It happened so many times that I couldn't pinpoint the one story I read 20 years ago as being definitely that one. It happened to so many women. And then as soon as I discovered that, I was kind of quite determined that that would play a part. And then once I had that idea, and I thought, well, if... Because I'm aware that I'm being a bit vague here. I don't want to give too much away to anyone who hasn't read it, because the Bridget's past impacts Blue's entire life, and that's what I really kind of wanted to get at. And I also, shortly after that, it was in the editing stages of writing The Grief House, there's a psychologist called Gail Atlas who wrote a wonderful book called Emotional Inheritance. And that is about how traumas of our parents or our grandparents can leak into the present generation's lives and affect them in ways that you'd be totally unaware of. And that whole idea, I think, is wild, that something can happen that you're not even aware of yourself to your parents or your grandparents, and it will impact you every day. And that was definitely the case with Blue, that she had no idea that her mother had this whole secret life before she was born. And she never spoke about it. Blue didn't know anything about it at all. And it wasn't until Bridget died, and Blue then had access to, you know, the paperwork and things surrounding Bridget's past, that she could start to piece together what happened in Bridget's life and why that had impacted her own life so much. And that was probably the most kind of planning I probably did. And the rest was just long walks and mulling it over.
Well, let's talk more about Blue then, because if all you really knew when you started off was that Blue was going to this place, how did you find out more about her as a character before you started? Like, what, for you to occupy this mind and write them, how did you learn more about who they actually were?
I think it just goes back to that my whole writing process, which is write a bit, walk a bit, write it down, and then just think about it, and then just I do become quite obsessive when I'm writing. The characters do inhabit every space of my mind. It's why it's so important that I switch off thoroughly before going back into parenting. I find myself, even in the car, just on my own, I'll think, well, what would they say to me? What would we talk about if that character's next to me now? What would we say? How would they respond to this or that? What would they think about the news? How would they, you know, what sandwich would they get if we stopped for a sandwich? And so it's a process of getting, it sounds so weird saying it out loud, it makes you sound like you're absolutely crazy. It is a process of getting to know this person that you have invented yourself. I'm really aware that all the answers that Blue would give me next to me in the car as we're driving along are answers that I have created. It is necessary, that kind of deep knowing of a character, I think it is necessary, and that I don't know any other way to do it. And I have, someone did recommend to me once, you know, just get a notepad and just write down everything about your character. And I did that with one of my previous books. And then what I found is when I actually started writing, that all went out of the window and they were just kind of themselves. So the process of getting to know my characters, I get to know them as I write the book. I think that's probably the easiest way to summarize it. I get to know each character as I write the book. And then with each redraft and each edit, I get to know them better and I can tweak what I've written to reflect them and their character.
And you did mention having to re-edit the story before you sent it off again to agents, and not knowing what genre it was in. So kind of having to hit beat points of a story that you weren't really sure about. So I guess what rules were you following yourself? I'll use the example of, I think it's Stephen King who never uses adverbs. Everything is said, nothing is ever said softly or anything like that. So I just wondered if you had any similar rules that you follow as you write that you will die on the hill upon.
Oh yeah, the ones I'll die on the hill upon, ing words. I hate them. I like speaking, walking, swimming. I just think they're, it sounds inelegant. Obviously, if words end in ing, like evening, that's fine. But I find it a very repetitive sound. I find it repetitive on the ear and repetitive on the eye. And I do slip into, when I'm in that kind of creative zone of just pouring stuff out, they're everywhere. And when I go to rewrite, I take them out wherever I can. And I always get really annoyed when when my editor or agent or copy editor tries to like swap a walked for a walking. I'm like, no, you will never do that to my book. So that's one that I always take out. It's almost like a tick, like I just can't bear it. One that's really important to me is verb placement. So if I'm trying to build pace. I try to keep the primary verb of the sentence as far towards the beginning as I can. So, you know, she walked, blah, 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 rather than, you know, lots of description and she walked.
Where does that come from?
Where does that come from? That comes from, I know where it comes from. That comes from a really, really great book called Writer's Tools by Roy Peter Clarke. He is a really, really great, I mean, he's a writer in his own right, but he has done loads of books on helping writers hone their craft on a really technical level. And I find his books enormously helpful because I think on some level, we all know what a good sentence is. We all know what we like to read, what flows well, what builds pace or what builds atmosphere. But actually to have someone tell you, do you know why that is? It's because the verb is right at the beginning of the sentence. Or do you know why you're having that really big brooding sense of atmosphere? It's because the verb is at the very, very, very end. So you're kind of building towards it. Yeah, he's brilliant. I really recommend him to any other writers who are looking for someone really, really to technically explain why a sentence works. That's your guy.
And that's it for this week's episode with Rebecca Thorne. Thank you so much to Rebecca for coming on the show. That new book is The Grief House and is out right now. Next week, we will be back with a brand new author. In the meantime, I've got another podcast that you can listen to. Who is the Cheese Wire Killer is sponsoring us for a little while. Give them a search. Put yourself in the heart of a true crime, something real life that is happening right now. Just search wherever you get your shows. Also, in the meantime, you can support us, patreon.com/writersroutine. Get to writersroutine.com and use the contact page if you'd like to say hello. And we are still clinging to the wreckage of X. We are at Writers Pod there, and I will see you next week with more writing routines. Until then, bye bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.